My name is Rick Kleffel, and welcome to Fine Print. Today we're talking with Carter Scholes, whose latest book is a collection of stories titled The Amount to Carry. His novel, now out in trade paperback, is Radiance, a tale of scientific and corporate angst set in a California weapons lab. Welcome to Fine Print, Carter.
Thanks, Rick.
Your roots as a writer are firmly in the science fiction world. Can you tell our readers about your first novel written with Glenn Harcourt entitled Palimpsests?
Yeah, sure. Palimpsest was written for Terry Carr's second series of Ace Specials, which were paperback originals published in 1983 and 84. They introduced a number of important writers to the science fiction world, including Kim Stanley Robinson and William Gibson. Terry was a really outstanding editor who had a real eye for individual voices. I felt, you know, honored to be in that series.
Now, it was released shortly after William Gibson's Neuromancer. Could you tell us a little bit what the novel is itself?
Sure. You know, talk about your tough acts to follow. the novel's kind of a time travel piece in a strange kind of way. It starts out on an archaeological or anthropological dig, a paleontological dig, where a strange artifact, a cube, is discovered. And that's kind of the MacGuffin that sets the novel in motion as the scientists try to figure out what the heck this cube was and where it came from. And it turns out that it came from our future.
Your next published work was a collaboration with Slipstream author Jonathan Lethem titled Kafka Americana. Now, this came out originally as a limited edition, I believe. Can you tell us what brought you to this project?
Sure. I was in a writing workshop with Jonathan. He lived in Berkeley for a while, which is where I still live. And we would have lunch together on a fairly regular basis. And one time at lunch, he was showing me a page from his notebook on which he had written simply the names Kafka and Capra. And he said, you know, this occurred to me the other day, and I've been looking at it for a week now, and I don't know what to do with this.
What a great idea.
Yeah, and I looked at it, and I said, well, I mean, that's all you've got, the two names? Well, you know, something about the similarity. I don't know. So I thought about this for a day or two, and then I called him up and said, listen, have you got any further notions about what to do with that, you know, page of yours? Because I think I have an idea for a story. And he suggested that we collaborate on the story. So I wrote the first few pages. Jonathan wrote a few pages more, and we went back and forth that way until we were finished and then sat down together to do a thorough rewrite. And the notion of the story is that Franz Kafka, rather than dying of tuberculosis in the 20s, somehow got a cure and escaped from the Nazi Anschluss and came to Hollywood and went to work as a screenwriter for Frank Capra.
Boy, well, that sounds quite entertaining. Now, your most recent novel is Radiance. It's set in the early 1990s in the Livermore Labs. You create a remarkable sense of place. What kind of research or experience did you bring to this book to create such a sense of reality?
Well, I have no firsthand experience working in that environment. I knew a couple of people who worked in that environment. I also knew a couple of people who had an active interest in, you know, opposing the work that was done at these weapons labs. So I had kind of both perspectives. And I've lived in California now for 25 years, so the sense of place is now just second nature to me. I've seen how the landscape has changed with the increased population, with increased development. And I wanted to give a sense of that, of the natural beauty of Northern California and the kind of civilized accretions that are happening on top of that landscape, and also the cultural accretions. And, you know, the weapons labs are very much a part of this. I've been aware of, you know, the lab since I moved here. So this was a way of really giving a portrait of Northern California as much as it was to look specifically at the labs.
You have a really excellent ear for writing accurate dialogue from high-tech meetings. The meetings in this book are an outstanding high point. Could you tell us about that?
Well, thanks. You know, dialogue, when people talk about realistic dialogue, you know, they usually mean something that's highly stylized. If you look at, say, you know, people say that Elmore Leonard writes great dialogue, and he does. It is great dialogue, but if you really look at it closely, people don't really talk that way. It's an extremely polished, refined, artificial style that gives you an impression of how the people talk. And what I wanted to do was to get closer to an almost literal transcript of the way people talk, which includes repetitions, not finishing sentences, being interrupted by other people. It was a sort of thing that I had seen approached in fiction before, but not quite to the degree that I wanted to do it. My great model for this really was William Gaddis. In his novel J.R., it's told almost entirely in dialogue. And again, it's not a literal transcription of the way people speak, because that's almost incoherent. If you try to do that, you find that out. It's a highly, you know, refined thing that Gaddis is doing. But that was my basic model to go from.
A lot of your dialogue and the prose style is a little reminiscent of the kind of cut and paste work we've heard from DJs recently.
Right.
And this, I believe that you've done a lot of writing for the music press. Does your experience in the music world influence your writing?
You know, I think inevitably it has to. It's not a conscious influence, but certainly, you know, it's part of my life experience, and it's bound to feed into the writing. I'm certainly aware of, you know, sampling and how one can piece together a piece of music from stuff that's just been snatched from the real world on a microphone and captured and rearranged. So yeah, I'm sure that was in the back of my mind operating as I was working this. You know, another influence, which was probably quite unconscious, but people have pointed this out to me, is the films of Robert Altman, where he mixes overlapping dialogue in a way, and I'm a great Altman fan, so although I didn't think of it consciously, I'm sure that's another influence.
Very interesting. Now, Radiance is set in an early high-tech environment. It's really a fascinating point in time that you capture. Netscape is still in the future. And you have an astute IT support person who provides lots of backdated good advice. You have a lot of fun with this notion of the future of the recent past, don't you?
Yeah, I do. It was fun. But there's a serious, you know, a subtext to this that it's a very interesting point in time, this 1993-1994 period to me. For one thing, this was a period when the Cold War was supposed to be over and we were supposed to be, you know, backing away from weapons systems, when in fact we did no such thing. It was also a time when the weight of the technological world was really moving from mostly military applications to mostly civilian applications. There was a lot of bleed through at that time. You know, semiconductors in the 70s were originally developed, you know, basically for military applications, and then the consumer stuff came later. The laboratories were actively trying to do that in the early 1990s because they were looking for a mission other than nuclear weapons, something to keep their funding up. So they engaged in what they called at the time dual use, which was to develop technologies which could be of some utility to corporations, commercial enterprises, you know, as well as possibly having defense purposes. So I thought the intersection of those two worlds was kind of interesting and had some satirical potential.
Oh, and you certainly mined it well. Now, you compare the high-tech renaissance of Leonardo da Vinci to that of Mark Andreessen.
Well, not Andreessen specifically, but Leonardo was a military engineer. He was hired by Ludovico Sforza for that purpose. The art and, you know, the other stuff was on the side. Oh, that's okay. If you want to do that, you know, we'll let you. But no. I mean, his job application, I think I can find this, the exact words in the book that he wrote to Sforza, included these words: "In case of need, I will make bombards, mortars, and fire-throwing engines of beautiful and practical design." So he really was submitting a resume to be, you know, a military engineer.
Your anti-hero in Radiance, Leo Hyatt, is just a fascinating character, and it's most enjoyable when you leap to his point of view partway through the book. He often mentions Da Vinci as he defends the weapons work of the Silicon Valley.
Well, yeah, Hyatt is an egomaniac, so you know, he has to see himself in these heroic terms. And he's aware, actually, that he's sort of conning himself, and he's conning the people around him. He has you know, what in another context I've heard called the reality distortion field. And anyone who falls, you know, sort of within his sphere of influence, you know, kind of believes his shtick. And Leonardo is just one of the images that he uses to get people to do his bidding.
Now, the protagonist of Radiance is a victim of the Peter Principle. It's most entertaining. He's an excellent physicist who makes a moral stand but finds himself literally at sea in a wash of multimedia messaging as a manager. Could you talk about that?
Right. I think that almost everybody who gets into a bureaucratic position like that finds himself in over his or her head and incapable of dealing with this. And you either learn to delegate authority very well and distance yourself from the stuff on the ground, or you get overwhelmed the way my guy does. You know, he starts out as a whistleblower on a very suspect project that he's been working on. This brings him to the attention of the regents of the university and to a senator who's very eager to oust Hyatt as director of the lab. And when Hyatt gets ousted, they're looking for an interim director. And our guy is, looks like the right choice. And he takes it, which is, a fatal mistake, because at that point, he's doomed.
Now, you spend a lot of time in the narrative establishing the feel of the world by describing the stream of symbols and words that flow by the characters and create this the environment of this manager who is just overwhelmed. Could you talk about your attempt to recreate in prose our immersion in media?
Yeah. And it really is a prose issue, I mean, as a writer, I'm very interested in the different discourses and rhetorics that can be used on the page and that are used, around us. People think of narrative prose as being primarily realistic or representational. You're trying to, open a window on the world. And that's true, but there are many, many different ways you can do that and many different windows you can look through. So I was really interested in getting all of the different rhetorics and discourses, or as many of them as I could manage, onto the page, whether it's the way people actually talk, coming, as close as I dared to a literal transcription of their speech, whether it's the kind of bureaucraties that you find in, government reports, or whether it's the signage that you see on the side of the freeway as you're driving down, or whether it's just snatches of stuff that you hear on the radio. All of those are different kinds of discourses and rhetorics, and all of them have their own particular agenda. And to have them collide like that, the way they do in our daily lives, on the page was something that I found extremely interesting, a challenge that I really wanted to hand myself.
It makes for some very beautiful reading. Now, Radiance is fiction about science, set in the early 1990s. In it, you're looking at the science of the past as it regards a future which is now our past. It's a sort of retroactive science fiction.
Right, yeah. And this is a technique that I think we're going to see used increasingly.
I fully agree. I think you're the first of a huge school that's going to be following behind you.
Well, hardly the first. I mean, the great model for that particular approach, I think, would have to be Gravity's Rainbow. Which came out in 1973 and was all about World War II, but seen through a very, contemporary filter. It's as if the kinds of things that happened, the sort of secret history of World War II, could only be told, two or three decades later through a sensibility that didn't exist in 1945, or at least, didn't exist in the literary world. So again, although that was not like a conscious model, and I think this book doesn't, get anywhere near what, Gravity's Rainbow does, it's still, obviously an influence. And I think that book is a great influence on a lot of other people who kind of came up in the science fiction world.
Now, one of the outcomes of this is that science fiction sometimes like to think it can predict the future, and your retroactive science fiction proves to be immensely perceptive in terms of the so-called prescience, ability to predict the future. You've got in your novel published last year, people thinking 7 years ago about, well, we better think about North Korea and, there's scandal at Livermore Labs. These things are hitting the headlines right now.
Yeah, well, of course, it always helps to have the benefit of 7 years of hindsight. But I will admit, I get a little bit chilled sometimes when I think, well, nobody really was thinking too much about North Korea when I wrote this, but North Korea was very much in the news in 1993 and 94. This was the first time that they had attempted to reactivate their reactor to make nuclear fuel. and the Clinton administration, you know, almost came to a military confrontation. It took, as I recall, Jimmy Carter to go over as an envoy to get them to back down, say, okay, look, we'll shut down the reactor if you will, you know, like, give us a light water reactor for energy. Well, in fact, the United States never did give them the light water reactor. So in a way, it was kind of inevitable that eventually something like this was going to happen again.
I guess in the science fiction world, as ye sow, so shall ye reap, also proves to be the defining
right.
rule.
Right.
Your characters often seem to be trying to map the world into mathematics, but the only math that works with their emotions really is chaos theory. You call it complexity on the edge of chaos.
Yeah. Well, and that, again, is just a rhetorical trope, one of those, you know, meaningless phrases that was like bouncing around Silicon Valley and in, you know, geek circles in the 90s. Yeah, of course, there's no way you can map the complexity of human experience, of human emotion, of human interactions in any kind of a mathematical model. This is one of the great fallacies, and it's one of the things that, you know, brings down all of these characters in Radiance, is this attempt to, you know, model a weapon system on a computer when you can't possibly capture all of the interactions. So yeah, it's a metaphor for the fact that things are intolerably messy and you can't really get a handle on them in any kind of rationalistic sense.
Now, you have some wonderful turns of phrase with regards to your science fiction history. Arthur C. Clarke gets featured both in Radiance and in your newest books, the collection of stories, The Amount to Carry. Could you talk about how you've updated Clarke's deliberately sterile approach to integrating scientific speculation and fiction?
Wow, I'm not sure about that. I have a story in The Amount to Carry, which is just kind of a...
It's hysterical.
An extreme, I don't even want to call it parody, sort of pastiche that uses Clarke in a kind of reprehensible way. The character in the story, who is named Carter Shoals, is submitting a story titled The 9 Billion Names of God, which is one of Arthur C. Clarke's most famous short stories, to a science fiction editor sometime in the 1980s, and the science fiction editor keeps rejecting it and accusing Shoals of plagiarism, and Shoals keeps coming up with increasingly tortuous explanations of what he's really doing, and it's not really plagiarism.
And you've also used Clarke to capture, I think, the entire industry of Silicon Valley with this quote, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from a rigged demo.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah, that's true. What Clarke actually said was any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And that... The altered quote is what Hyatt says to some of his underlings.
Now, in your new book, many of your stories seem to perform science fiction experiments on prose itself.
Yeah, well, again, that speaks to my desire to encompass as many discourses and rhetorics as I can. I mean, one of the things that was interesting to me about science fiction as I started to write, you know, as a reader and also as a fledgling writer, was that at the time, in American fiction, there was a kind of a hegemony of realism or naturalism in all of the big magazines like The New Yorker and so forth. It was all, you know, suburban angst and slice of life, and with a few exceptions, of course. They did print Donald Bartlemy, you know. But by and large, that was the tone, the voice of American fiction. And to find anything that was outside of that, you mostly had to go to science fiction. Now, outside the U.S., I don't think that was quite as true. I mean, you had, you know, Garcia Marquez in South America, and certainly before him, Borges, and in England, you had Angela Carter. I mean, there were a lot of people who were writing stuff kind of outside of strict naturalism that was also accepted as literature. Not so much in this country. So that was one of the things that attracted me to science fiction, but I was also attracted to a lot of other writing. You know, one of my heroes is James Joyce, whose first book, Dubliners, is written in what he called a style of scrupulous meanness, and is still kind of a model of economy and compression for prose writers. But then he went on to write Ulysses, which is, you know, 18 chapters, each of which is in a different voice and style, one of which, in fact, is a practically an anthology of English prose styles across several centuries. And this to me was, you know, just fascinating. There's a great line in an essay by Gilbert Sorrentino, the novelist, where he refers to the aberrant mode of realism, that upstart of imaginative writing, which really captures it for me, you know. I mean, it's a fairly recent innovation. And if you look at the exemplars of naturalism, if you look at Hemingway's prose, for example, is always held up as a realist. It's anything but realist. This prose is extreme. I mean, it's masterful, but it's extremely stylized.
It's interesting because as I looked and read the stories and the amount to carry, I thought this is a kind of literature that you would find in the New Yorker or the Atlantic Monthly. It reads like that kind of quality. It's innovative, interesting, intellectually challenging. Then I looked at the publication credits, and they were all in genre magazines.
Sure. Because, you know, at the time that a lot of these stories were written, I think it's less true today, but at the time, those publications were really not open to that kind of work unless it came with a brand name attached. I did try to sell some of these stories, actually, to, you know, so-called mainstream markets, and I failed. Science fiction was more open to them at the time.
Could you tell us about what we can look forward to from you next?
Oh, well, I'm a very, very slow writer. I have begun work on another novel, but it's very early days, so I'm afraid even to say anything more than that.
And as far as secret histories of science, I think that those look to be taking their realm in the place of fiction, much in the way that horror tends to create a secret history that nobody hears about. I think that you'll be writing more secret histories of science.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's inevitable. Things are moving so fast now that you really, you know, sort of have to move as fast as you can to catch up with the past. I find it really interesting that that William Gibson, the author of Neuromancer, his most recent book, now on the Times bestseller list, is set in the year 2001. And he hasn't had to alter his style or approach one iota.
Not at all. And finally, can you tell me where my flying car is?
Your flying car is at the New York World's Fair of 1963.
That's what I was afraid of. We've been talking to Carter Scholz. His most recent book is The Amount to Carry. It's a collection of short stories. His novel is Radiance. Thank you very much, Carter.
Thank you.